This Week in Radio Tech is brought to you in part by the Broadcaster's Desktop Resource on the web at thebdr.net.
And now, our feature presentation.
Twert.
You've dialed in to This Week in Radio Tech, episode number one, Tsunami.
All right, calm down. He says that to everyone.
This calls for immediate discussion.
What's up,
Dad? All your data belong to us.
From his palatial office of important business.
Or in a choice hotel in a distant land.
This is Kirk Harnack.
This week, Tom Ray, Chris Tobin, and special guest, Rich Wood.
You're dialed in to This Week in Radio Tech.
Welcome in, and we hope you'll make this podcast a part of your weekly routine. If you're a broadcast engineer, a radio engineer, if you're interested in audio engineering, if you want to know more about RF engineering, how to make good quality sound, you want to know more about setting up a studio in your home, or you just want to know more about how radio works, whether it's analog radio or digital radio, this is the podcast for you. We're going to have guests and some co-hosts from all around the world. In fact, earlier today I was speaking with Elliot Steckman in Mumbai. He'll be one of our occasional co-hosts, as well as some folks from Ireland, from Germany, and we'll have guests from some of the biggest companies in broadcast equipment manufacturing and also consultants with us as well. So on today's show, I've got a couple of co-hosts with me. First of all, Tom Ray of Buckley Broadcasting. Hi, Tom.
Hey, Kirk, how you doing?
I'm good. Tell us a couple sentences about yourself, Tom.
Well, I'm Vice President, Corporate Director of Engineering at Buckley Broadcasting, and I'm fresh off doing battle with a transmitter today, so I'm in rare form.
All right, I'm sure we'll get to hear about that. Also with us, another co-host from New York City is Chris Tobin. Hi, Chris.
Hello, Kirk.
I understand you're with CBS Broadcasting, is that right?
Yes, CBS Radio in New York City. I'm the Broadcast Technologist and Engineering Supervisor for our six-station group. And today, I did not have transmitter issues. I did have STL wind conditions. We had 50-mile-an-hour gusts in Lower Manhattan. And our STL dishes pointed toward the Statue of Liberty, definitely opposite from our transmitter facility.
Ouch. No transmitters at the Statue of Liberty, are there?
Not that we're aware of, that we're allowed to talk about. You know, black vans come and go from time to time.
Also with us on the podcast today via Skype is Rich Wood. Hi, Rich.
Hello, Kirk.
Your resume is too long to go over. Maybe you can just tell us what you're doing right now, Rich.
Well, I'm running my own company called Richwood Multimedia. Effectively, I'm a consultant. You know, one of those who ruins radio.
Not okay. Necessarily. I know some that have been very successful in keeping it going.
Exactly.
Rich,
well, I'm doing mostly projects.
Rich is our guest on the show today, and you may not hear a lot from Rich in the first 15 or 20 minutes or so, although Rich, you're certainly welcome to chime in on the technical issues, but we're going to be talking to Rich beginning in the second portion of our show, and Tom and Chris and I will have some questions for Rich, and he's going to talk to us about a number of issues about the radio industry, kind of where things are now. And also, he's going to talk to us a bit about HD radio, digital broadcasting, and content. So Rich has a lot to say about those things. I'm looking forward to talking to Rich about that. But let's get to the topical things of the day. Guys, we got a little list of things to talk about, and one of them has been how radio served or perhaps didn't serve during the recent disasters in American Samoa, little tiny piece of America way out in the Pacific Ocean. I happen to know a little bit about American Samoa because I'm part owner of two radio stations in American Samoa, KKHJ-FM and also WVUV-FM. Now, those of you who follow call letters will find it interesting that there is a K call letter and a W call letter in the same little remote part of America out in the Pacific Ocean, but that's the way it has worked out. And as you know, about a week ago, there was an earthquake southwest of American Samoa, southeast of the independent nation of Samoa. Those are some island groups separated by about 60 miles. And that earthquake caused a tsunami, and that tsunami was not insignificant. It caused some between 10 and 20 foot waves to come into the harbor of American Samoa, the Pongo Pongo Harbor. there were lives lost, 32 or 34 lives lost in American Samoa on the main island there. The main island there is called Tutuila. But to the broadcasting part of it, I'm part owner of a radio station that's located in the harbor area. It got hit pretty hard. It's on the second floor of the Pongo Plaza building there. So it didn't suffer any immediate damage, although all the stores and offices on the first floor certainly did. But I understand that our staff there was able to transmit a warning about the tsunami. We have some records of that warning being transmitted, and it was transmitted with a protocol in the broadcasting business that we call EAS, the Emergency Alert or Emergency Activation System. I'm not entirely familiar with EAS from top to bottom. We have equipment that is in the station that is required to be there to transmit some data for automated systems, and it also receives warnings from other radio stations or from the National Weather Service or other official channels. But Tom Ray, I know, has some experience with EAS. Tom, maybe you could tell me what's been your association with the EAS system, and how it's supposed to work if there is an emergency, and what broadcasters do with this gear.
Well, when I worked in Connecticut, and actually now that I'm director of engineering for the group, and we have radio stations in Connecticut, I was part and am part of the local emergency communications committee in Connecticut. And in New York City, we have just started reforming the LECC because we haven't had an active one in a while, and we've been having some EAS issues in New York. The way it's supposed to work, there's a plan, which can be either set up by the state or in the case of New York City, because New York City is such a unique place, it is treated as its own state by the state of New York and by the Federal Communications Commission. So we kind of have our own EAS plan, and that plan sets forth a protocol. For example, you may have some stations that run weather alerts, and they may drive you nuts. Up where I live, there are five counties that come into basically a point at that place. And every time the storm moves into a different county, there's a station that sets off EAS for everything. You get an EAS alert. Usually you get five of them within 10 minutes of each other as that storm is moving through, which can be a royal pain. So this sets forth the protocol. It sets forth who is going to set off an alert. It's usually some city or some governmental authority, for example, the Office of Emergency Management in New York and in Connecticut, or the state police, or someone who has reason to say, okay, this is a bona fide emergency. Let's activate. The station can also do it on their own, and that's what really impresses me about this American Samoa incident, because apparently the disc jockey who was on duty when the earthquake happened, the National Weather Service, from what I've read, did not yet issue the tsunami alert, and he knew it was coming. And it's probably because of him that a lot of lives were saved, because he took it upon himself to say, okay, I'm going to issue a tsunami alert.
That's the case as far as we can tell. Yeah. Yeah.
And the whole thing, you know, for us broadcasters is, you know, the way it's supposed to work is you've got the authority who says, okay, we have an emergency. Here's the issue. The broadcasters are good at getting the message out. Sometimes we're not real good about putting the message together, but we're good at getting the message out. So they hand the message off to us, and we're supposed to transmit it. And there's somewhat of a daisy chain effect, where when I transmit it, maybe Chris picks it up, maybe Rich picks it up, maybe you pick it up, and we get the message out to as many people as possible, because let's face it, not everybody's listening to your station, not everybody's listening to my station, and that's how it's supposed to work. A lot of times it, unfortunately, doesn't work that way, which is why in New York City we're reforming the committee to examine some problems we've had as of late. So, but this American Samoa thing is the perfect way that EAS is supposed to work, and I don't think you could actually tag a number to how many lives were saved by this, but I can guarantee that lives were saved because that warning went out.
I know that there were certainly plenty of people who died in the harbor area of American Samoa, and I believe there were people who were able to head for the hills or get to higher ground, or at least get out of some buildings that were demolished when that tsunami wave came in. So, Tom, I understand that normally an alert like this would be originated with a governmental agency like police in case of an Amber Alert, or the Weather Service in case of some kind of hazard, yeah?
That's correct. And just the fact, like I said, that the DJ at your station knew what was going to happen after that earthquake hit. And he issued the alert before the National Weather Service said, you know, there's probably something there. Because a lot of times, something like National Weather Service, once they see it, then they issue the alert. Hmm. But this guy jumped on it before he did. And EAS actually is intended to be a warning system. You know, some people will think that, for example, in New York City, to this day, people are still bemoaning the fact that EAS was not activated on 9/11. Well, we didn't know it was coming. We did not know it was coming. And EAS is intended to save lives and to alert people for an event that we know about. So in this case, it worked perfectly.
Yeah, it's interesting that when we have a heightened awareness of something, that sometimes our reactions will change. As we're recording this podcast today on Wednesday, October the 8th, I noticed that there's been a tsunami watch, and then it's been moved up to a warning, actually, for a good part of the Western Pacific Ocean, including American Samoa. There's just been a couple hours ago an earthquake that is near the Vanuatu Islands. It was an 8 magnitude earthquake. Well, the Weather Service is on top of it now. They've already issued a tsunami warning, the Pacific Tsunami Warning Center. So there's the official channel coming in. So radio stations, at least U.S. licensed radio stations in that area, will do that. Chris, how about you? What experience how do your stations treat EAS? And is it any different than other stations in the New York City area?
No different. The EAS is treated in the same manner. Thank goodness we haven't had too much of a reason to activate it. And we receive the alerts for testing. We do our weekly tests. We do monthly. Try and make sure the system is almost infallible. But, you know, there are humans involved, so there are times when it's not 100%. But I think part of with EAS in general and the former EBS from years past, the hardest part that broadcasters have is still, you know, when you alert somebody to an emergency you think is pending or is on the horizon and it fails to come to fruition, now you run the risk of, you know, the Chicken Little or the boy who cried wolf. And I think the Samoa incident is a great example of somebody taking the initiative and saying, hey, you know, this is what's happened. We know what happens usually after it. We should be prepared and go for it. Here in the States, though, I've heard a lot of situations where EAS comes out, people hear the little tones, oh, yeah, blah, blah, blah. And then that's it. So I think in the larger markets, we're very cautious. Smaller markets are probably more communal, you know, more community-minded, and take advantage of EAS, what it has to offer.
Kirk, you said something interesting before when you had mentioned that the National Weather Service had already issued issued a warning, a watch, and then issued a warning. The National Weather Service protocol, a watch means that conditions are favorable for a tsunami, for a tornado, for a thunderstorm.
True. True.
A warning means it has been spotted. That's not a, gee, the conditions are right here, we're expecting it any moment. That means we have seen it. And that can be a big delineation with activating EAS and saving lives.
So the warning means there is evidence yes, this is happening, and you are going to need to take cover.
It means the conditions are ripe.
You
know, for example, in the case of a tornado, we've seen rotation in the clouds. We've seen the clouds coming down slightly, but we do not have a tornado yet. When they issue the warning, that means it is officially a tornado. Get out of the way.
Rich Wood, is there ever a conflict between the requirements of the FCC and engineering versus the people who do content, who maybe don't want to be bothered with so many times the alerts having to be broadcast?
Well, it depends. You know, it's the cried wolf thing. If it happens too often, last week, I think there was an incident with a Christian station that was the originator, known as the LP1, where the person ran a test, and he forgot, he realized he had made a mistake, and he forgot to send the end of message tone. So that meant the other stations that were connected to this network were running Christian programming.
This is the squawk at the end of the EAS test that says, hey, we're done with the test. You can go back to your normal programming now.
And, you know, I can go back to the first test that we did in New York. And Tom was there. And everybody, it was done by the classical station, WQXR, and they did essentially the same thing. So almost every station in New York played classical music as long as it took for engineers to cut wires, pull plugs, and the hip-hop stations were not happy.
Oh, and of course, the engineers listening to this podcast know this, but the EAS equipment oftentimes is hardwired into the programming chain. So
well, unless the station is manned 24/7, it's required to be wired in just in case there's a presidential alert.
Well, initially, I believe we were wired in, and then changed our minds when we discovered that this was not perfect. I have a vivid mental picture of you running around.
Trying to get audio back and pull the right cables to plug everything back together.
We were a talk station, not classical.
Some years ago, when EAS started, I was working. I owned some radio stations in Mississippi, and their plan was, the execution was not so good. And a radio station in Jackson, Mississippi, issued either a weekly or a monthly test, and we were required to retransmit it. Well, they forgot to play the end of message signal, and then they ran a dry cleaning commercial. Well, every radio station in the state of Mississippi that was properly participating ran the same dry cleaning commercial. So it's good to know that if we ever have a dry cleaning emergency in the state of Mississippi, we're prepared for.
What you're saying is the client got his money's worth.
And then let me add something to that. This was a human mistake. The FCC declared it to be willful and fined the station $5,000. Now, that's not very much of an incentive for stations to get involved in this. It was not intentional. And I don't understand, you know, why the commission does that sort of thing. My guess is that they're exclusively charged with reducing the deficit. They're finding everybody.
Yeah. Well, a lot of people get these when something bad happens, when there's news to find out about, when the weather's bad. You know, a lot of people still tune to AM radio stations.
Yes.
A lot of stations across the country that are big news talk stations or have a big have a weather department or some kind of affiliation with a big TV station. These are so often AM radio stations. Especially, I've noticed on the East and West Coast. New York City certainly has some very popular AM news stations, and so does the West Coast. I was just in San Francisco, where you have a plethora of popular, highly listened to AM stations in that area. The subject has come up lately about is AM radio still relevant, except for in times of emergency. Tom, you're the engineer of a big AM station, WOR, in New York. What are your thoughts about AM radio and its relevancy?
Well, I would hope it's still relevant because WOR is the biggest station in the Buckley chain. I think it depends on the audience, and I think it depends on who you ask. You know, if you were to ask my 21-year-old son, AM radio, why bother? He doesn't even listen to terrestrial radio. He listens to satellite radio all the time and stuff online. If you like talk programming, if you're into news, if you're into sports, AM's the place to be because that's where you'll find all of that. It'd be nice if we could go back to some music and some quote unquote normal formats, but you know, AM's become the land of talk, news, and news, weather, and sports.
All you need to do is ask somebody who went through Katrina just how valuable WWL was.
Oh, yeah.
You know, there's no FM station that could cover. And many of these people ended up in Houston and, you know, considerable distances away from New Orleans. So this was the only signal that could keep them connected to New Orleans. So, you know, it would be a shame to see this disappear. And the other issue is it's not really dying in all markets, because the virtually every major market has usually a 50 kilowatt station in the top 10. KGO, San Francisco, for instance, has, I don't know what the count is, but they have been number one, you know, since dirt was invented. And it sort of looks like it may be cracking a little bit. But, you know, these are stations that generally have dedicated news staffs. The FMs do not. So I'm not sure I want, I don't think I want the morning zoo giving me my news, you know, because I don't have a lot of confidence in their journalistic qualifications. So, you know, AM would be a terrible shame to see it disappear.
Chris Tobin, you are the engineer for a big AM station in New York as well. Are you finding that there are more technical reasons why people either can't or won't listen to AM radio? I hear about man-made noise, or I try to tune in an AM station. For example, I live 5 miles from the WSM transmitter in Nashville, Tennessee, and I don't have any problem picking it up here, but, you know, there's other stations in Nashville, other AMs in Nashville that I don't pick up so well here in my office. How are people listening to WINS in New York?
Well, I'm grateful that WINS's signal is directional toward Manhattan, New York City, the five boroughs, and total dominant area of Arbitron. But I think the question really should be, is radio relevant? Because the way we're going as an industry, I don't think people are tuning in, tuning out because of the technical reasons. I think they're not tuning in for anything unique. So for WINS, which is a perishable programming material, all news, it's live. Everything we do is live. The few elements that are taped are just that few. So our content is constantly changing. So the audience is always looking for something we'll tune in, tune out. If you look at our numbers, you'll see that, you know, QM is high, TSL might be a little lower than you'd like, but for the format, that's exactly what you'd expect.
So QM is people tuning in,
yeah, sampling what you have. Time spent listening is they tune in, sample, and say, oh, I like this, and stay with you through that time period. Rich would agree with that.
So time spent listening is you're a headline news type of radio station, yeah?
Yeah, we're definitely a headline, quick, in and out, here's the story, the man on the street type of thing. You pick up the newspaper and you quickly skim through the first two sentences of each paragraph and say, okay, that's the story. If you want more in depth, then you go to other types of all news stations.
Gotcha.
But I think AM is still relevant. It depends on the content. I mean, we also in our CBS group have WFAN, All Sports, and it's the top rated sports station in America, and like number three, I think, online for people streaming sports product in the
website. And let's also note that even though it's not number one, it spent a very long time as the top billing radio station in the industry.
Right. So that's the other thing you need to consider is, you know, relevancy as to number one, or is it, you know, your billing that makes you number one, you know, or is the perception of the audience in the market? You know, WQXR, old classical station of the New York Times, may not be number one, but for what they're trying to achieve and their audience, they are the top dog. You know, you talk classical music to anyone who's an aficionado, and it's WFMT, WQXR, and then the others fall into place.
Mm.
So there's the relevancy there.
Yeah, let me add something. Back in 9/11, WINS, had the largest audience I think ever recorded. I remember being at a convention where a representative of Arbitron came in with graphs, and the we'd never ever seen that kind of audience. So WINS has the distinction of being what we call the crisis station.
Yes,
you know, it's
true.
Where you automatically go when something goes wrong.
I fondly will tell folks when I give station tours, they ask about the radio station, you know, what makes us different. I say, well, it's two things. One, in your kitchen, you have appliances that you rely on when you get up in the morning, coffee maker, toaster, whatever it might be. We're one of those appliances when you get up in the morning. And the other appliance we are is that break glass in case of emergency. When something happens, you want to find out whether it's a pending storm, the latest in the New York Yankees World Series or pennant race, or something even greater. And that's how we are.
See, that's what I miss in Western Mass. I have no idea who the crisis station would be. Nobody seems to be doing much.
Yeah, not every market has a station like WOR, WINS, or KGO in San Francisco.
Right. But a lot of these stations, a lot of the markets, I think we're suffering as an industry from the how much money can you make fast, or, you know, what's the return on my investment if I do this particular format? And since the business has become a commodity in the last two dozen years, it's difficult now. If you wanted to be the crisis station in your market, say, you know, Western Massachusetts, I'm sure there's plenty of broadcasters who could fit that bill, but they can't justify the cost, or at least by today's standards, let's put it that way.
Right.
And I think that's what's really a disservice to everybody, just, you know, industry, audience, or just, you know, business in general.
Well, bottom line is that it's content.
Yes, it is.
That's most important. And, you know, you'll find that even through all the noise of, let's say, nighttime AM radio, if there's something somebody wants to listen to, they'll bear that noise.
I can tell you a story. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Rich. Go ahead.
No, I was finished.
I worked at an AM station, a 1,000-watt radio station. The actual RF was 787 watts into the gain of the antenna. But we did a full-service AM format. So it was adult contemporary music with news, sports, business, all kinds of other things. And it's very, very community, local. We had a lot of stuff. You know, the local mayor would be on once a week, various different parks department folks, the whole bit. But we did contesting, and the contest prizes would vary from, you know, dinners at a restaurant to pizza pies for parties of seven, whatever. We would get audience calls for contest winners from places outside of our listening area. So our primary area was local, lower Fairfield County, Connecticut. Okay, that's the towns of Greenwich, Stamford, Norwalk, Wilton, New Canaan, Bedford, New York, the whole bit, right along that Gold Coast, we'll call it. Our audience that we would get from outside of that was coming from the residents of New York City, boroughs of Queens, Brooklyn, Staten Island, Bronx, sometimes parts of New Jersey on the other side of Manhattan, which I can assure you when I've traveled to those neighborhoods to find out how our signal could be heard. With the GE Super Radio, number one, first generation, second generation, it was pretty decent. With the standard car radio, you had to fight the ignition noise of your vehicle. These were folks tuning in because they enjoyed the contesting. They enjoyed the content that the jocks were putting out there. The music was incidental.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just a classic example, as Rich points out, the content. And I'll never forget that, where we're like, wow. And the program director would always joke in meetings and say, look, the music is just filler. It's about what we put around it. And at first, this is 1985, 86. I'm like, what? What are you kidding me? To this day, I still believe the content is the best way. You can have all the technology in the world. It won't mean bupkis if nobody wants to listen to what you have to say.
Right.
Here's an interesting merging of technology and content, and I wanted to cover this before we get to the interview with Rich Wood, and that is the subject of doing broadcasts outside of the studio, going out to where the news is or where the people are or where the car sale is, and actually broadcasting from there. Now, here in the U.S., we tend to call this a remote broadcast. And in the rest of the world, they call it an OB, an outside broadcast.
Right.
And one of the technology things that we wanted to talk about on this podcast, our first one, is some of the technology and how this is changing. Yeah, years ago, we, as broadcasters, used equipment called MARTI equipment. And that's a brand name, but it was an FM radio, basically, an FM transmitter, an FM receiver that operated in a special, a couple of special bands that the FCC had set aside for broadcasters to do remote broadcasts. It was called RPU, remote pickup. And then we went to, the quality kind of went down. We tended to go to a lot of phone lines. We used various frequency extenders to get a bit more bass out of a phone line. And then it became quite convenient and acceptable to do outside broadcasts, short ones, via a cell phone or maybe a small mixer hooked into a cell phone. Well, now as technology is moving along, we're still using some technology from the phone company, and that would be the ability to pass IP packets over a cell connection. In the U.S., we have EVDO technology. This is often called 3G. So you might have an EVDO telephone. You might have one that does HSDPA. In other countries, or here in the U.S. in some places, where we can get a reasonable rate of data, just like an internet connection, we can get a reasonable packet rate from one place to another. And so what I wanted to talk about for a couple minutes is in New York, Chris and Tom and maybe in other markets, what are you guys doing to do live remote outside broadcasts, and how are you using some technology to get audio from the live remote broadcast back to the studio where you can rebroadcast it? Tom?
Well, in a lot of cases where we can get it, we're still using a phone company ISDN technology, which is a digital phone line. We have recently started doing remotes on IP. We get broadcast quality over an IP line with a very small packet size, very low data rate. It actually sounds pretty good.
Now, is this a wired connection or wireless at this point?
Well, this is a wired connection. Now, we tried, a couple of weeks ago, we tried going with a wireless cell phone card in New York City. I'm told by the manufacturer this particular model or particular unit we were using, not in New York City, because just the density of cell phone users. The broadcast was at noon, and it fell apart on the air. Oh, did it fall apart? Oh, my God, did it fall apart on the air.
And this was because of an inconsistent data rate through the 3G network?
Well, what happened was, the broadcast started at noon, and it was in Times Square, one of the worst places in New York to have a cell phone at noontime, because all the offices let out, everybody comes out and flips open that cell phone.
Yeah.
And, well, that was number one. Number two, it was on a Wednesday, which is matinee Wednesday, and in Times Square, which is close to the theater district, you've got even more people involved with cell phones. The UN was in session. And let's add one more. The Secret Service was in town, and they were probably doing selective jamming at certain places, and that all conspired just to throw it up, take the data connection and break it to pieces.
So let me back this up just a little bit, and I meant to disclaim at the beginning of the show, my employer, Kirk Harnack, the host of the show, my employer is Telos, Omnia, and Axia, and Telos was one of the early manufacturers of ISDN codecs. That's a codec being a coder-decoder, putting an audio bitrate reduction scheme like MP2 or MP3 or AAC to work to squeeze digital audio down to a rate that'll fit over an ISDN line, for example. And now companies like Telos and like some competitors to Telos, like Highline or Comrex or AEQ, these companies are making codecs that where the connectivity scheme is now IP, Internet Protocol, and that this would imply that it's over a wired internet connection or maybe a private WAN type of connection, some kind of a nailed up connection, you might call it, or it might even be a wireless connection. I know that a number of broadcasters have had good success with a wireless connection, but it depends completely upon the ability of the provider, usually a phone company like Sprint or Verizon, or in other countries, Orange or British Telecom or whoever it may be, to provide a connection that gives you a consistent enough data rate for real-time audio to pass from one place to another via these IP codecs.
Interesting to note that this was a Comrex access that we were using, an IP box made by Comrex. 2 weeks earlier, we went down, well, matter of fact, on Labor Day, we did a remote from the parking lot at Rutgers University because WOR carries Rutgers Sports, and it was opening day for, it was the first football game. We took our afternoon drive host, Steve Malzberg, and sent him down there with a microphone, a Comrex Access, a Verizon wireless card, and he used the thing on battery and walked around and did a whole half-hour pregame show, and the thing was perfect.
I bet it worked great, yeah.
It was wonderful.
Yeah, I had the same thing happened to me in Miami. Actually, I was setting up for a Latin American broadcast show on a Sunday using a Sprint EVDO card and using the Telos version of the product that you were using, Tom, called the Zephyr IP. Mm-hmm. And on Sunday, when nobody was in downtown Miami, it worked great.
Oh, I bet.
But Monday morning when, you know, a quarter million people come to work in downtown Miami, it didn't work so well. And I measured the data rate using a PC that I was getting from Sprint, and it was maybe 38 kilobits in one direction and 24 kilobits in the other direction.
And I don't know about the Telos, but the Comrex needs about 46 kilobits to maintain that connection.
Yeah, it's about the same there, yeah. So I guess, Chris, do your stations do some outside broadcasts, and are you using any IP technology to do those?
Yes and yes. We do, the AM stations do a lot of broadcasts outside, and matter of fact, 1010 Winds does IP, we do a lot of IP broadcasts, both wireless and wired. Matter of fact, every morning you'll hear at least one reporter, if not two, using their laptop with a Verizon card, in this Verizon and or Sprint. We have two carriers. We don't keep everybody in one basket. And we've had about a 90%, 95% success rate. Some of the research I've done and have found out that EVDO, even though it's a very nice technology, the 3G systems, the radio interface, not the part after you connect to the Verizon or Sprint networks, their internal networks, the radio interface portion has been designed for best effort. So if you are in a busy area, say like Times Square or Herald Square, there's a good chance that the radio interface on the cell sites will get overloaded, and you'll be forced into a lower data rate, the 1X RTT, which is that real slow stuff. We've been able to sort of keep an eye on that. With the software that comes with the card, you can keep an eye on which version you're on, EVDO high-tech or the 1X RTT low-tech. So using that as a gauge, we're able to avoid some of the pitfalls of losing connections. Wired-wise, we go to many offices and report stories and cover sports, plug right in, and off we go. No issues there with IP. But most of our breaking news events for news and for sports, we do have to rely on the cell phone because none of the equipment's designed to just run in real fast and be portable like the old RPUs were.
You know, my experience has been exactly the same, and I go to a lot of different markets and try out wireless IP connections as well as wired ones too. And one of the technologies that debuted where I live in Nashville, Tennessee, earlier than a lot of other markets, has been WiMAX.
Right.
And there's a company, used to be known as Clear Wire, now it's called Clear. And they rolled out WiMAX in Nashville as well as three or four other markets a couple of years ago. And I understand plenty of other markets are getting WiMAX too. And my first experiences with WiMAX, and I haven't had any since then, but my first experience was actually really good. We had a desktop-sized modem, wireless modem, to talk to the WiMAX network and measured the data rate. We were getting 2 megabits down and about 512 kilobits per second up. And, of course, this worked fantastically with the Zephyr IP IP codec. It would have worked with anybody's with this kind of data rate. So in a market like New York, is WiMAX something that's available to you?
I don't, you know, I haven't had anybody approach me about WiMAX yet. I've heard it's coming in, but I haven't had anybody, come knock on the door and say, hey, you guys interested?
Yeah. Yeah. Chris?
You won't because of, I've talked to two of the WiMAX carriers, if you will, and they're not certain how to approach broadcasters with the model that we are familiar with. You know, we as broadcasters can call a SBC, American Telesis, AT&T, Verizon, Orange, whomever, and ask for, say, ISDN. And they have a tariff, and they know exactly how to deliver it to us.
And that tariff means it's legally defined as to how it's going to operate. Yeah,
exactly. By, you know, Public Utility Service Commission, whatever it may be in your state. The WiMAX community, or the wireless community, some of them, there are tariffs that cover what we do, and then there are tariffs that don't even come close. Talking to two of the WiMAX carriers and explaining to them what I'd like to do with their technology, they were all on board. Oh, yeah, we can drop in a little pizza box antenna. You could put on a tripod, have a modem, and have a 3-megabit connection. Great. How much? $5,000.
Holy cow.
I only want to do it for one day event. Well, that's our structure.
Not going to work.
Exactly. So I spent months with these guys. They just could not get their head around it. They're just on a different level. I'm hoping somebody allegedly in the first quarter of 2010 is introducing mobile WiMAX in New York City. Mm-hmm. We'll see if that comes to fruition. Right now, WiMAX does exist for point-to-point and for point-to-non-line-of-sight connections here in New York City. Oh. It is available. But I'm looking for a mobile. I want to be able to take a pizza box antenna on a tripod, throw it in Central Park, be connected, and have my remote broadcast.
You know, here in Nashville, they're selling not only the desktop modems, but also modems. They're a bit big and clunky, but still they're USB connected devices that go into the side of your laptop, just like the 3G modems. They're a bit bigger, but that's the notion. And if the coverage is strong enough and good enough, it seems like that should work. Now, all this, I would imagine, with WiMAX, maybe not with LTE, which is the next thing, or the supposedly a bit more sophisticated than WiMAX, but WiMAX, wouldn't it suffer the same problem if you have enough subscribers that you have with the 3G services? You end up getting a very low or spotty data rate?
Not necessarily. The WiMAX and LTE platforms are being designed for the multimedia audience, I'll call it the multimedia. They're actually designing the radio interface for a more robust connection rather than the original 3G, which was driven by voice communications. How do we take our analog cell sites that have 12 channels per carrier and triple that? Well, we take that digital stuff and we squeeze it down into little bits and we could do more. Well, there was no thought of going beyond simple phone calls. That was the premise behind all that.
Yeah.
As we all know, technology has evolved and the cell phone was sort of in the middle and people just assumed they could do it because it's wireless and it's technology. It's digital. Why not? The phone companies found out the hard way, as we all know if you have an iPhone and travel the countryside, where it works well and where it doesn't. Mm. What's happened is the forums, the consortiums have decided to focus more on the end user and say, how would somebody take advantage of this device? And I think you'll see a huge improvement in the way you can deliver that experience, both WiMAX, LTE, or what they call 4G, I guess is what it's going to be called, or 5G, I guess, in parts of Europe. That's what you're going to see happen. So, yeah, you'll still have some issues maybe with, you know, propagation, multipath, whatever you want to call it. But I think the companies developing these technologies have realized they need to be more robust and create a better experience for the end user.
We're going to need to spend an entire episode on just this subject of IP connectivity, and then another episode on wireless IP connectivity. I think this is a very interesting subject because it has implications not only for broadcasters, but for all like Skype, just doing being able to talk to your friends with your laptop or perhaps with a Skype application, which I believe now is just today got approved for the iPhone after all.
We've actually used Skype for some of our news broadcasts during the elections, and it worked very well.
Ah, okay. All right.
Hey, in that other, that separate show, you're going to have to add the legal problems. Philadelphia, as an example, the government of Philadelphia wanted the entire city to be wired for
Wi-Fi.
Mm-hmm. And the telephone companies sued them.
That's right.
Philadelphia got a reprieve, but other cities are. I'm not sure exactly where the court case is, but the telephone companies see the governments, much like healthcare. They see the governments putting them out of business.
Yes, the Philadelphia incident.
They don't want to do it themselves, but they don't want anyone else to do it.
Right, and that's where the FCC needs to step in and stop subsidizing and protecting both telephone companies, the telecoms, and the cable industry. They're creating monopolies legally by doing that. That whole Philadelphia thing, if you talk to many folks in the communication circles, like public safety and stuff, they were up in arms. They were like, this is a total violation of any fair business practice. Mm-hmm. And nobody challenged it. Hmm. And that's really what it is.
Is the public Wi-Fi network in Philadelphia usable at any good data rate, or can you just get your email on it and that's about it?
I think it's barely usable. Mm-hmm. It's a very low data rate when you can find it.
Hard to imagine that a municipality or any organization, whether it's private or public, could provide a free service that was anything near the equivalent of what you'd have to pay for.
Right.
Well, that was their intent. Yeah. It was to be free.
Yeah. I don't know. I had a feeling from the get-go that this isn't going to work, or at least it's not going to work very fast. If the idea was to provide internet connectivity to folks who couldn't afford it, and it was just barely good enough to get your email or to maybe look at the New York Times website, okay, fine. But it's not going to provide you with anything faster than that. I don't think you're going to be able to watch a YouTube video on a free service.
Well, actually... In New York, there are several pockets of Wi-Fi. Bryant Park, I think, was the first. It's right behind the library. Mm-hmm. Used to be one of the most dangerous parks in the city. Now it's gorgeous. There, I think, are just a bunch of kids that set it up. So if you're in the park, you've got a Wi-Fi connection. And it's free. And there are several others around the city.
There was a service provided in Central Park as well.
Yes.
The same thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, myself, I like to go get me a Big Mac and get me the free Wi-Fi at McDonald's. And if you live...
Do you have the choice of getting the artery-clogging sauce or not?
Yeah.
And you guys may not have Crystal Burgers where you live, but in Nashville we have Crystal Burgers, and they have free Wi-Fi as well.
Well, you could go to Starbucks and pay $7.99 per location. You know, you can do it for all day if you want to sit at the same place. But if you go to another one, you pay the $7.99 again.
Now you can get an AT&T plan, and I believe you can still use your T-Mobile plan at Starbucks, and that's just a one price per month, $20 or so a month,
right?
To use that at any Starbucks, and I've certainly used that quite a bit. Hey, Rich, thanks for chiming in, and you know we've got about 10 minutes, maybe 12 minutes left in the podcast, and so much to talk about. I can tell right now that as this podcast evolves, we're going to need to reduce the number of subjects we try to cover and cover them more in depth. By the way, I want to encourage people who are listening, if you want to comment on this and give us your feedback, the website is thisweekinradiotech.com. Of course, if you're listening to the webcast, you probably already found the website, because until we get on iTunes, that's how you got it. We have some questions for Rich Wood. Rich has been a programmer with a lot of the big shows across the country. Rich, I happen to notice from your list of accomplishments that you were, for a time, associated with the Doug Steffen Show, which was always, frankly, one of my favorite shows. And I was an affiliate. Stations that I owned were affiliated with the Doug Steffen Show, as well as being with the WOR Network and a lot of other things that you've done. Rich, boy, there's so many things we could talk about, but I think you had one particular item on your mind that you wanted to be sure and talk about in this podcast, and that had to do with the state of radio broadcasting today in terms of in corporate terms and in terms of the downsizing that's been occurring for several years in the broadcasting business, in radio in particular. Would you like to open that subject up?
Well, I probably shouldn't, but
that's never stopped you before, Rich.
No, it's a family show, but we can be controversial.
Thank you, Tom. Radio stinks when you come right down to it. And one of the reasons for that is that, it's kind of a double whammy, which was the law being changed that allowed, let's say, a company like Clear Channel to own 1,200 radio stations. Now, they've since found out that no one on earth can operate 1,200 radio stations. But the issue really is that Wall Street is now in charge of programming radio stations and getting rid of people and that sort of thing. So we're not programming to listeners. Mm-hmm. Actually, for years, we have not been programming to listeners. We've been programming to Arbitron, but now we've got a second. You got to program to get your stock price up. And that's where all of the downsizing is happening, and all the most, some of the most creative people that I've ever met in this business have been let go because of downsizing, you know, just to please Wall Street. And, you know, it's happening everywhere. It happens less when it's a mom and pop operation, you know, and I'll take Buckley as an example. Even though there has been some downsizing there, but it's owned by a family, and you know it's private. They don't have to worry about you know, they might have to please a bank, you know, pay for some equipment, but the other ones just can't be creative, too expensive. So you know we've got. We've got voice tracking. We've got Ryan Seacrest everywhere. We're going to have Elvis Duran everywhere. And these are, you know, these are the kinds of things where, you know, if you're in New Orleans and there's a, or for in Massachusetts. I mean, we've got lots and lots of Polish and Indian names that no one who wasn't born here could pronounce. So all of these things are coming in, and it's clear it is not from here. So, you know, we've got a whole bunch of things that are happening at the same time. You know, it's a, and I'll take partial credit for it. I created the WOR radio network. But my advice to stations was don't fire people. Let them do something else. And that was the same thing when I was in music syndication. You know, who needs a person to sit there and push a button to start a record? Let a machine do that. And let the talent do something more productive. But what actually is happening is the technology is coming in and the people are going out. So if we go back to the content being important, I really think, you know, Wall Street doesn't care about content. You know, they're not programmers and they probably don't know what a radio is. So we've got, you know, we got some serious problems with consolidation and the tremendous lack of local programming. And that, you know, the most fun radio now is small markets where you can pretty much do anything. It was like a station I started at. I programmed my own music. I did my own show. Nobody bothered me. I have no idea what the ratings were. But now it's all, and I talked with a program director of a top 10 market this morning. And we were talking about how program directors no longer have any authority. And he ended the conversation by saying, oh, somebody's there to tell me what to do. And that's what it is. It's all being, you know, it's centralized. And the people who are actually there in the market don't have, for the most part, and my job at the network was to deal with the radio stations. So I know almost all of the program directors at all of the talk stations, and I hear the same thing over and over and over again. I have no authority. So, and these are people who made the stations, you know, what they are. So it's a shame.
Rich, I can't find anything to disagree with you on, especially as an owner myself of four small market radio stations, and as a guy who myself finds myself listening a lot less to local radio, to radio that's in my market in Nashville. I just don't find much interesting except some talk. Some of that's local, some of it's not. Let me ask you this, Rich. Is it possible, are there some programmers responsible for a number of stations who are still doing a good job? Or is it even possible to do a good job with 10 radio stations?
Well, see, there's another issue. Okay, it used to be one program director per station. Now you have what are called clusters. So the general manager is managing 8 stations. I can only imagine if WOR had 7 other stations. The station is so difficult, so complex to run, that I can't picture the guy I worked for, who's Bob Bruno, I can't picture him, you know, doing, maybe he could do an AM and FM combo, but could anyone properly do 8 stations in a market? They're all going to get cheated. So it's, you know, the station that I particularly respect is in Philadelphia, and it's a guy that I've known for years, Jerry Lee. It's a one-man operation, one-man owner, and Jerry does it right. He promotes like crazy, which most radio stations don't do. He helps advertisers do good commercials, which most stations don't. You know, they usually have the salesperson write the spot. And, you know, this is a radio station that has made lots and lots of money, has been, I would probably call it the KGO of music radio. It's done well. It's very expensive. But it's done very well. You know, if that happens to be your taste in formats. The last person I think, who really had, autonomy was a friend of mine that I met in San Diego, John Minnelli, who really became a guru for a very long time, for talk radio. Ended up doing 2 stints at WABC. And, you know, he brought, it's in San Diego, an almost nothing radio station to, near dominance. And then went from one market to another and finally, to New York. He's now consulting. John, I think, was the last person that I know who had absolute autonomy. And that just doesn't exist anymore. And you can't second guess as a manager or an owner. You can't second guess the program director you hired because of his expertise. You know, it's a we used to talk about it a lot at WOR. You know, don't hire somebody and then make them do something else, you know, that you didn't hire them for. So that's basically what's happening. And it doesn't sound good. So to give you st- stations, specific stations. You know, each market probably has one or two, but the program director job now is pretty much an operations manager who takes care of making sure that, you know, when you do remotes, you know, he makes sure that everything is coordinated and all of that.
Rich, we've only got a few minutes left, and I can tell that we need to have you back on, and perhaps it's our own podcast. And by the way, for the listeners of this first podcast of This Week in Radio Tech, we are considering a whole nother podcast just called This Week in Radio that will deal with a lot more of the programming and ownership things that that Rich and other consultants can talk to us about. Rich, I want to finish up, though, with one question. What is your take on Arbitron's PPM, personal people meter? How do you think that's going to affect the way stations are programmed?
Well, it's already started. We've seen smooth jazz shot to death. It doesn't work well with it for some reason. It's really too soon to know why. Arbitron is being sued by the Black Broadcasters Association because it doesn't seem to report urban listening. As well as the diary, and stations are panicking, in my estimation.
Who's benefiting from PP? Whose numbers are up? What formats?
Generally, talk. If I look around and music intensive stations, so I think what you're going to see is more music, less talk.
Is this though indictment of the diary method that Arbitron has used for years? Isn't PPM supposed to be more accurate? And couldn't it at least be argued that even if it has some flaws, it is more accurate?
Oh, I think so. I've been a supporter of PPM for a long time. Electronic measurement is good. Most of the people. You know, who filled out the diaries. The diaries start on Thursday, which is why all the contests are at 7:20 in the morning on Thursday.
That's right.
All right. So Wednesday night is usually the time they sit down and fill out the diary for the week.
You mean the week that they has just passed?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. So what happens is they fill out what they think they heard. Yeah, and so if you're a station that's established top of mind awareness with, you know, this particular diary person, then you're going to get it, even though they may have been listening to someone else.
Mm. Yeah.
So it's what we have to do is now figure out how to program to PPM to get some numbers out of that.
So it's no longer going to be necessary for me to hear on my favorite music station, if someone asks you today what station you listen to, be sure you tell them it's, or you're listening to Q102, write it down.
You
it's
better
a different
not
type of
hear
recall.
That.
A
yeah, you
type
better
of
not hear that because there'll be a little sticker on the, if it's a diary, and the PPM is only going to be in a limited number of markets. Mm-hmm. So you'll see two possibilities. One is a sticker that says there has been unusual, not so good activity in this market by this radio station. Or Arbitron used to be famous for saying, hey, you do this, we'll put you below the line. And below the line basically means a signal that comes in from outside the market. And you know, if you're below the line, you're dead.
Okay.
So it's it needs some work. I think it's going to work, but it's certainly going to be better than the diary was. And the people who are complaining are the ones who are losing numbers.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, okay. Back to your point about people filling out the diary on Wednesday, I remember many, 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 many moons ago when I first got into the business, We had a station in town that was a daytimer AM. They signed off, and this was winter. They signed off at 4:15 in the afternoon.
Wow.
They came in number one, 7 to midnight.
Well, you know, we actually had the same thing happen in Boston.
Like, hello?
A station, WILD, was a black formatted station. It was a daytimer. And Arbitron came up with something called, differential survey treatment, something like that, where they would help minorities fill out the diaries. The assumption was these people weren't qualified, intellectually qualified to do it, which is a stupid assumption to start with. And WILD ended up being in one book, number one, when it was off the air.
This day and age of the internet and streaming, it's not out of the question that could happen nowadays, but still, I mean, come on.
Oh, yeah. It was something that I think was a serious mistake, and it was done with Hispanics and black listeners. So I think diminished Arbitron's credibility for a while, because there's no possibility that those stations could have been number one at those hours.
Goodness. On that note, I'm going to have to wrap things up. We're a little over an hour right now on our first podcast, episode number one of This Week in Radio Tech. Our co-hosts have been Tom Ray of WR and Buckley Broadcasting. Also, Chris Tobin of CBS Radio in New York City as well. And our guest today has been Rich Wood. And Rich does independent consulting now, and he's been in the consulting business for a long time in the radio broadcasting business. We're going to have Rich back on again. Of course, Tom and Chris will be back again soon as regular or semi-regular co-hosts. I'm Kirk Harnack. Thank you very much for listening, and we're going to be back next week with another episode of This Week in Radio Tech.